Hello and welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. What if everyone, regardless of income, everyone in America, was given a monthly check with no strings attached? That's the fundamental idea behind a rather old concept, but it's beginning to gain some popularity. It's called Universal Basic Income, or UBI. From Hawaii to Silicon Valley, from Finland to Scotland, there are some basic income pilot projects that are underway around the world. As a matter of fact, a bit closer to home in Stockton, the Stockton Economic Empowerment Demonstration is hoping to launch a trial run of universal basic income coming up this coming August. They plan to do a random sample of 300,000 residents, and each resident will receive $500 a month with no strings attached. In Ontario, Canada, the basic income experiment is targeting low-income residents. There, single people can get up to $17,000 Canadian dollars. Couples would get $24,000 per year. And there are some case studies of basic income projects around the world. And those studies have found that there's a feeling that social problems such as poverty, unemployment, crime, dangerous work have all grown over time, and that traditional policy solutions haven't helped any of those things. So is this the right way to go? Is this the right discussion to be having? Should we be looking at the possibility of a universal basic income, and would it make society better? We have two proponents of the idea. And joining me to discuss universal basic income are Larry Cohen. Larry is the founder of buildthefloor.org, and he's working to create coalitions and UBI advocates all across Los Angeles. And he's also a founding signatory of the Economic Security Project. And he runs the Los Angeles Basic Income Meetup Group. So he's joining me in studio. Larry, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, indeed. Welcome. And also joining us is Carl Wiederquist. He's an associate professor of political philosophy at SFS Qatar, Georgetown University. He's co-founder of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network, and he's co-founder of Basic Income News. That's a news website of Basic Income Earth Network. Wiederquist has published several books and lots of articles on UBI, both in academic journals and in the popular media as well. And Carl is here. He's in the studios of WWNO in New Orleans, Louisiana. Carl Wiederquist, thank you for being here.
Hey, great to be here.
Thanks so much. I'm going to start with you, Carl, because you have been looking at this phenomenon of UBI for more than 20 years. Can you just briefly give us an overview of what is UBI and where has it actually worked?
UBI is the idea that income doesn't have to start at zero, that we don't need to have threatened people with poverty and destitution and homeless and living on the street in order to get them to work. We can have a non-zero income that goes to everybody that's enough to meet their basic needs. And then as you make more money, sure, you're going to pay taxes out of that more money, but the rest is yours to keep. So you're always better off making some private money. So you have an incentive to earn more, but you're not threatened with destitution if you don't.
And can you give us an example of where this has worked?
Well, a fully fledged UBI, large enough to live on, is still untried. We've had things that move in that direction, but not quite tried. In Alaska, they have a small basic income, which in the past has usually varied between $1,000 and $2,000 per year, not enough to live on, but something that makes a big difference to people who need it. If you are a single mother with four kids and you get a check once a year for $2,000 for you and each of those kids, that's $10,000. That makes a huge difference to people living on a margin. And you find that this has helped Alaska have one of the lowest poverty rates in the United States and have some of the greatest economic economic equality in the United States.
And that's the result of oil and gas revenue that's being distributed among Alaskans. Is that the source of this money?
Well, indirectly. What they did is when they started making oil revenue, they put a small, very small amount of it aside and put that into a fund, and this comes from the returns to that fund. Now, if you look at Alaska's wealth, it is one of the wealthier states, but it's not the wealthiest state. It's not that much wealthier than the average state. So if you look at all the funds they have to draw on, it's not just because Alaska has all this oil. It's because Alaska seized the opportunity. When they were making this revenue from oil, they chose to do it with this. Whereas what our federal government does is when they have an opportunity to make a bunch of revenue, they usually just give it to private industry. We gave away the broadcast spectrum to private industry without making them pay anything. If we'd have charged them the way Alaska charges companies for its oil, we could have had a big fund created out of our oil spectrum. We could do the same for all that we do for our banks and things that we do for our gold mining industry, for our bottled water industry. Alaska is doing what the United States could do on a whole. We could create a basic income on this basis.
So it is kind of working in the micro. Based on your research, how long has the idea been around?
Well, you can trace it back as far as ancient Greece, where they did something like what Alaska is doing with its oil, with a silver mine that Athens owned, but it wasn't a fully fledged idea, and of course it was only for the citizens. It was a small part of the country back then. The first person who was getting close was Thomas Paine, actually, the great patriot. Thomas Paine, in his book Agrarian Justice, argued for a one-time redistribution to help people get started when they come of age. And then someone responded to him, a lesser-known figure named Thomas Spence, who said, well, rather than the one-time thing, how about a regular payment? And that is the first exposition of basic income. It's also been talked about by figures such as Bertrand Russell, Virginia Woolf, and people as diverse as Martin Luther King, James Tobin, Milton Friedman, and Richard Nixon.
Wow, how's that for a spectrum? Interesting in that it's been around for a long time, since ancient Greece. But more recently, it turns out that the 15 to 34 demographic is really latching on to this idea. According to the European Social Survey, the main drivers of support for UBI are the youth, 15 to 34, people who are unemployed, and students. And Larry, you're here with me, and I don't know, I can look at you and tell you're probably a millennial. And how do you explain the embrace of this idea among that demographic?
Sure. I think not just people of my generation as millennial, but people of all ages recognize the changes that we're going through right now in our society. We're recognizing that technology is, in a way, changing the very way we do work and how we run our society. We have 21st century technology that's allowing us to do more with less of our own labor than ever before, which is creating incredible prosperity and wealth creation. And I think all of us are seeing that being created, but that wealth is going to a very small groups of people. And what I think UBI does is recognize that we can build a 21st century society that will go along with our 21st century technology, because we would be creating a foundation, a floor of income, so that everyone could use to build their own American dream. And I think it's critically important as we move into the 21st century and we deal with the disruptions of our technology, that we ensure that people are able to pursue more meaningful work and transition from the system of the 19th and the 20th centuries of labor into the more meaningful work of the 21st century technology, and allow people to choose the kind of work that they should be doing with their lives, that they choose to freely do with their lives.
And you think that millennials see this as a way of addressing income distribution inequities?
Absolutely.
In what way?
I think a lot of people, if you don't have your basic needs able to be met, you are constantly struggling in a place of insecurity where you have to take whatever opportunity is given, even if that opportunity is exploiting you. And so I think basic income provides the freedom of basic economic security, which is critical for anyone to be able to take the next steps in their lives, having that basic starting point, which if you're from a well-off family, you sort of take for granted. But for too many families, almost nearly half the country can't afford a $400 emergency bill. So we need to ensure that everyone has at least a starting point, a strong foundational starting point on which to go and be able to take advantage of the life that they want to go lead. And that will lead us into a transformation of work in the 21st century. So we'll be moving away from exploitative, unnecessary labor, and we'll be ensuring that people are choosing they have the freedom to choose the kind of work that they want to be doing. And that'll lead to the better outcomes that we want to see from each other.
You know, it's interesting. This time of the year is when you expect for retail jobs to really start to explode. It's the holiday season. Retail outlets really need more help. But according to Quartz Media, this year there are 170,000 fewer retail jobs and there are 75,000 more Amazon robots. So it appears to makes your case that there are 20th century jobs and there's a 21st century reality. And again, just explain how you figure that just something as minimal as, say, $10,000 a year creates a floor. I'm not sure that that's even a floor in a place like, say, the Bay Area.
Sure. I think that you need to take a step back and look at, I'm in favor of about $1,000 a month, which is about $12,000 a year, which is the how we describe as the federal poverty line. So that's the starting point that we've created for ourselves in this country. I think that, yes, will people be able to take a basic income and live, you know, on the beach in the Bay Area? Probably not. But what it does allow is for people to ensure that they will be able to cover their rent, that they will be able to buy food, that they will be able to make decisions of their own free will on how they want to lead and to live their life, and where they want to go with their life, and to be able to say no to the kinds of labor that we should be actually moving away from and letting our technology do. And we can fund that by allowing our technology to help pay for this basic income, allowing us to go do the more meaningful work. There's so much work out there that isn't being given value right now, whether it's childcare or family raising or taking care of one's family, volunteering or the open source movement. There are so many different things that people want to be doing with their lives that are really meaningful that aren't necessarily paid work. And then there are other people who want to create startups and take advantage of the technology that we've created to improve our lives. And we should be able to allow that opportunity for everybody as a starting point. I think we'll be better off with it.
I must say, I've been hearing this conversation. This year is the first time I ever heard of the concept of universal basic income. But I've, you know, heard conversations about it, walk past cafes, people are kind of talking about it. And we're wondering what callers think about this idea. What questions do you have about universal basic income? What do you think about it? Could it become economically and politically feasible? And what considerations do you think need to be weighed in this conversation? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, or you can go to yourcall@kalw.org. We're fortunate to have Larry Cohen, founder of buildthefloor.org, who's creating coalitions around the idea of UBI, and Carl Weiderquist, an associate professor of political philosophy, and he's co-founder of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network. And we look forward to hearing from you. Let's go to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Oh, okay. Ruth Ann had to hang up. She says, I live on Social Security disability. I feel like I live on what a UBI program would look like. So to some extent, Carl Weiderquist, there are people who are sort of already experimenting with this very thing in their lives. Yes?
Well, yes, in that sense. But what you have with something like SSI is you've got to show that you have need and deserve it. And it often puts people in a very difficult position, is that they have to prove that they can't work in order to get it, and they can't even do part-time work. I remember speaking to someone who has an intermittent disability where they can work for a few months and then it flares up and they can't work, and they had no program for them. So their choice was really to try to remain out of the workforce all the time to stay eligible for SSI or to try to work even when they were physically or mentally unable to keep up with it. And that puts people in a very dangerous position. And we have other people that simply don't qualify for anything at all. The idea of basic income is to stop the judgment, stop thinking about we're better than the poor, we know better, they are bad people, what they need is for us to fix them. Poor people don't need us to fix them, they need us to get out of their way and stop taking all the resources and saying you can't have them unless you do work for us. Everybody needs to get a share of the workforce. A share of the resources that we're using. If we're going to privatize the land that was here for all of us, we've got to pay somebody out of a share of what that returns. Now, $10,000 a year is probably not enough. $12,000 a year is a small start. That, I think, is very affordable, and we might be able to do something that is far more generous, maybe $20,000 a year or more.
You know, it's interesting. Just this very week, in the discussions about the tax bill, the new tax bill, Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley gave his reasons for why Republicans think it's important to give a tax break to those at the very top of the scale, the estate tax. And to explain that, he said, well, if you give a tax break to people at the top of the scale, they're going to invest that money back into the economy, whereas those at the bottom of the scale will spend it on, I quote, booze, women, and movies. All righty. I'm going to tee that up for you, Larry Cohen. There is a certain feeling, if you will, in the land about poor people, working class folks, and what they would do if given the opportunity to have just a basic income without having to work. You want to address that?
Sure. I think with Senator Grassley, I'd like to point out that, in my personal opinion, I believe the amount of money in one's bank account doesn't decide your value as a human being. I think that what you bring to this world and what you do with your life isn't necessarily reflected in how much money you're creating for somebody else or for yourself. And so to say that, you know, only rich people are doing the right kind of work and the right kind of things with their life, I think is very short-sighted and speaks down to the vast amount of Americans who are working very hard at multiple jobs in the gig economy, trying to make ends meet, and just being able to hang on by a thread or not, or being one step away from poverty or suffering through poverty today. So I think that's quite demeaning and degrading, and I think that there is a way that basic income helps sort of take away the exploitation, the idea that some people are worth it and some people aren't. This is a universal program that would ensure that everyone has that starting point. And I think if you look at the studies that have been done on cash transfers, you find that there isn't an increase in unemployment or a decrease in a lot of work hours. What you see is women who are raising kids going back to stay at home and help take care of their kids as they grow up. You see teenagers who are working who go back to school because they no longer have to earn money simply to survive. You see people in economically distressed areas taking opportunities to start new businesses or to create their own startup locally, to take opportunities of risk and try to make a better life for themselves. I've had the chance to talk to hundreds of people in the last year. And not one of them has ever said that a basic income would mean that they would just go sit around and do nothing. Every single person I've talked to has dreams. Every single person I've talked to has ideas about how they would want to improve their life and to live their life to the fullest in a meaningful way. And I think basic income makes that happen as a better opportunity for everybody.
Well, let me tell you some of the conversations I've overheard. That goes something like this. Human nature says that if you remove incentive, people don't work, and that some things that are intended to be a safety net for some people will become a hammock. Hmm. That's the other side of that argument.
That's a bad mischaracterization. We are not talking about equalizing everyone's income. We're talking about creating a basic income, which is specifically designed to have incentives in it, is that you pay taxes when you earn more money privately, but you keep most of what you earn privately. You always have an incentive to make more. This idea that we have that if you don't threaten the poor, or not, and you're really not just threatening the poor. You're threatening every single worker who can't afford, who is not independently wealthy and can't afford to retire right now. You can, every one of us, you're threatening them. If you don't keep working, we are going to make you destitute. You will be living on the street, sleeping in doorways, and eating out of dumpsters and begging. That's the threat that we're all under. We're not talking about removing incentives. We're talking about making a minimum so you don't need to fear that. Your incentive is given to you by private wages, and after-tax wages can be much higher. I've done some recent cost assessments where I look at one large enough to eliminate poverty, and I find that a basic income large enough to eliminate poverty, the average recipient would be a family of about two people making privately about $27,000 a year, and then after taxes and their basic income is receiving a net subsidy of $9,000, bringing their income up to $36,000 a year. Basic income is for everyone who works for a living. It's not just about the poor. It is about giving everyone this opportunity to say, I don't have to work. Make me an offer that will make me want to work. When people are saying how people don't respond to incentives, what we need is, we do have an incentive problem. We have an enormous incentive problem in this country that has shown up in the last 40, 50 years, which as employers do not have an incentive to share the benefits of growth with their workers. And the reason they don't have incentive is the workers don't have the power to say no to bad jobs. You give workers that power, then you give employers the incentive to pay better wages. That's the incentive we need. And if you provide those incentives, everyone will work. We have an old saying in my part of the country, everyone has their price. If you give people enough, a high enough wage, you can get them to do just about anything.
Larry Cohen, you had a thought on that?
I think two things. One, the idea that people just trying to get a foundational starting point would cause people to not work. Basic income allows you to do any kind of work. It allows you to go and do maybe more unpaid labor, whether that's taking care of your children or volunteering or any of the vast amount of work that people do today that is currently unpaid. It's incredibly valuable, super important for society, and yet not currently valued in our system if you're just going off of how much money you're raising. And on the other idea that, you know, we're having these massive tax cuts for people who are wealthy and their kids are able to have all their basic needs taken care of, and no one's questioning the inheritance of these kids being this tremendous amount of wealth being given to them. Are we worried about those kids not working? Are we worried about those kids not providing enough back to society to make it worth to have them show that they are worthy of that money? No. But we're making that assumption about, you know, people who don't have as much money as they do. That's absurd. And I think basic income allows people to do the kind of meaningful work, whether it's paid or unpaid, that rings true for them. And that's what the kind of work that we need in the 21st century.
Well, in many cases, I think, again, just to push back on the idea, it's not the basic part of the UBI equation. It's the universal part of the UBI equation that some people have a hard time wrapping their head around. Sue in Oakland has that concern. Hi, Sue. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, exactly. So that's my concern. I can understand there being some sort of cap on income where people making or surviving on a certain amount and below get this, but I see no reason whatsoever logically that anybody who is already affluent or making a decent wage or whatever would get this. My other point being, you keep mentioning people who are working. There are plenty of people who cannot find jobs, and for many of the reasons that you stated, maybe they're already receiving benefits, they have to stay under a certain level of income to receive benefits, or they lose their Section 8 or they lose their food stamps or whatever. And would this also include them still receiving those? Because, for example, in the Bay Area, where rents are $2,000 for a studio apartment, $1,000 is not going to help cover that, plus their health insurance, plus their food stamps or whatever people may be already receiving. So those are just some of the concerns about this idea. And also $1,000 in the Bay Area, that's great. personally, for me, that would be really helpful. There are so many volunteer opportunities in my community I would love to be able to do, helping with children, the elderly, others, and I can't because it's unpaid. So, I don't know. It sounds like a wonderful idea in theory, but in practice, not so sure. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to let Professor Weiderquist tackle that one.
Sure. Hit so many issues there, so many really important issues that I hope I can remember to address them all. Okay, one was about why do you give it to everyone rather than just those in need? And another one was about, is it going to replace other things? I have done a cost assessment recently of doing a basic income at $1,000 a month, which is just enough to eliminate official poverty, with a marginal tax rate of 50%. And the cost of this, even if you did not cancel a single other program, the cost of this is $539 billion a year, which is 2.95% of GDP. That's 25% of current entitlement spending. And that's about 10% of the federal budget. So it's not... it's not hugely expensive. It's less in cost than this big tax cut only for the wealthy. That I believe the cost of that we're having, it is something that we can afford even if we don't eliminate other things. Now there might be other things that we don't need once we have it. With a less generous one, well, like $1,000 a month, you can't cancel everything else. But also you don't necessarily need to keep everything else. So you have somebody who's making. Who's on SSI of $12,000 a year, is the goal of basic income so that person can have $24,000 a year, or can we have some kind of replacement of that? If you have a much higher one, a $20,000 a year basic income, which would cost several times the $12,000 one because of how it works with the tax system.
Okay, Carl, I'm going to stop you just for a second because Sue had so many tentacles to her questions. Lots more folks. Obviously, folks are really interested in this, and we have just the right folks to answer those questions for you. Okay. Associate Professor Carl Weiderquist and Larry Cohen, founder of Build the Floor, talking about universal basic income. We're going to take your questions right after a break. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And today we are talking about universal basic income. What does it actually look like? There are lots of varying visions about just how this would work. And how do we answer those who are very concerned that this is a very slippery slope into socialism? You hear the S word a lot associated with this idea. And here to talk about it is Larry Cohen, founder of Build the Floor, who's working to create coalitions and UBI advocates across Los Angeles, and Associate Professor Carl Weiderquist. He's a political philosophy professor at SFS Qatar, Georgetown University. And they're here to take your calls. And let's start with Jason, San Francisco, in the second half of the hour. Hi, Jason.
Hi. My question is how you see universal basic income affecting inflation if 10,000 or 12,000 becomes the new zero, and that gives people more expendable income, what kind of effect that would have on rent and other expenses as more people can suddenly afford to spend considerably more? Thank you.
It's true. Once people get more money, then prices just go up corresponding with that. What do you think about that, Larry Cohen?
Sure. Well, thank you for that question. I think that's a common thought that people have when you hear about basic income. I think you have to take, again, a step back and understand that this is not just all new money that's being created. This is taking money and utilizing it in different ways. So, you know, we have to understand where our money is going to today that could instead be going toward a basic income. So what are the costs of us not having a basic income today? What are the costs of poverty in America, whether it's high incarceration rates, lower education outcomes, or higher hospital costs and hospitalizations? Yeah, what is the cost that we are paying in the trillions of dollars, both economically and in the lost potential of those who can be doing more meaningful work and leading a more meaningful, positive life than being trapped in poverty? So we're already paying these costs. And, you know, if we can take, we can get some of that back and we can definitely not have to worry about creating this all from new money. We can utilize the programs that we have and the system that we have so that we're not just inflating prices. That would not happen because we're not just creating new money out of nothing.
And before we went to break, Sue from Oakland had a really good question, and I imagine it's pretty common, Carl Weiderquist. Why give affluent people money to? Why not target it to people who need it most?
You could do that. You could say, okay, we're going to have $1,000 a month for people who have no other income, and then you'll get a little less as your income goes up until it gets to zero, and then we'll start taxing your income. That program is called the negative income tax, and it's similar to basic income. What basic income does, it's not about raising the after-tax income of Bill Gates. Bill Gates, if you introduce this, is going to receive his $12,000 a year in basic income, and he's going to pay much more in taxes. Now, the reason we do this is because NIT might sound simpler because you're not both paying somebody and taking it back. But we give it to wealthy people, not because it's good for wealthy people to give them, because it's good for people with low income if we give it to everyone, because they don't have to prove at any given moment that we have low income. When you're looking at somebody's taxes, you've got a year to assess their taxes and to get that right, and we make it much more complicated than it should be. That's another story. But to find out how many taxes a person owes at any moment is really hard. So let's say that you're married to a man and you find out that he's been abusing your children. And so you have to run it and say you've been specializing in taking care of the children, and he has been specializing in making money. So you've had a really high income. So under a negative income tax or our traditional welfare state that we have, you then not only do you have to flee, but then in order to have any money tomorrow, you have to go to some government agency. You got to figure out where that agency is, go to them and prove to them that you don't have the money that you had yesterday, and give them a good reason. When you have basic income, you get that check every week, regardless of what else is going on. Then when you go back into the labor force, you pay taxes on that, but that money is always there. So it helps people in distress. And that actually turns out to be an enormous amount of people who are net recipients of any sort of a welfare program is people in a sudden crisis. Basic income is the best thing you can have for people in a sudden crisis because it's already there. So instead of taking the money out of the basic income as your income goes up, we just tax your income, or we tax your spending, or we tax your resource use or your land use or something. We tax something that you're doing with money as it goes up, but we tax here and we give the money and basic income there because that is better for the people who need it in any given time.
So the money travels with you. It's mobile, literally.
Yes.
Larry Cohen, your thoughts?
Yeah. Just to add on to that, the idea is, you know, everyone would get that $1,000, but like Carl said, you know, if you make a lot of money, you'd probably pay into the system more than you would be getting out, but it would net out so that you would be getting it, and it simplifies the system so that everybody gets it. But those who are really wealthy, or those who, you know, own certain industries and maybe tax slightly higher, that would end up being paid more into the system. So you wouldn't have to worry about those people or about rich people ending up with $12,000 more because they're paying more into the system in the first place. But also, I just want to take a sec to say that, you know, no matter what wealth level you have, we want to make this clear that universal basic income is universal and that everyone deserves that floor. So if someone who's wealthy ends up losing their job tomorrow, they too can expect to be able to stand on that basic income and be able to bounce back and start rebuilding their life. So that's why it's simpler to implement and provide for everybody instead of trying to target it. And by building it as a universal program, it ensures that everybody has that same foundational starting point.
All right, let's go to another
one. Can I add something as well?
Okay, sure, go ahead. Carl?
It nets out to $539 billion a year, 2.95% of GDP, and that's the inflationary pressure that spending gets. Basic income is not any special kind of spending. All government spending creates inflationary pressure, but all government taxation creates deflationary pressure. If you can counteract that inflationary pressure of spending by having the deflationary pressure of taxes. So as long as you keep taxes and spending in reasonable balance, basic income isn't any more inflationary than any other government spending.
Well, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities writes, there are over 300 million Americans today. Suppose UBI provided everyone with $10,000 a year. That would cost more than $3 trillion a year and $30 trillion to $40 trillion over 10 years. This single-year figure equals more than three-fourths of the entire yearly federal budget and double the entire budget outside Social Security, Medicare, defense, and interest payments. It's also equal to close to 100% of all tax revenue that the entire federal government collects. Now, my eyes glazed over a little bit just reading that from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. But, Larry, do you have some thoughts on how you can possibly justify a program with these kinds of numbers?
Sure. Again, that's a very simple formulation. You take the basic income and you multiply it by the number of people and you say, that's a huge number. We can never do that. And I want to go back to the idea that what are we paying right now in the cost of a basic income? Because we can definitely afford it. There's no question, based on some of the numbers that Carl has shared with us, but also just seeing at the general picture. We're between the cost of poverty and the lost potential of hundreds of millions of people because they aren't able to do the meaningful kind of work that we need more of. We're losing trillions in the cost of poverty and the cost of hospitalizations and taking care of people who fall into poverty. And we recognize those costs. We know those costs and we study them and we just sort of say, oh, well, that's just the cost of our society. That's not true. You know, when people have that basic foundation, a starting point, you can help prevent a lot of those costs and not only prevent the cost of poverty, but tap into the potential and the opportunities of those people contributing back to society and being able to do the more meaningful work and create, who knows, the untold contributions of hundreds of millions of people. You know, how many Einsteins have we lost out to because we haven't been able to ensure that all kids have a basic starting point where their needs are able to be met and they can have enough food on the table and get a good education in a secure home? You know, we have no idea what we've lost because of that. So between that and not even getting into the general programs that we have, both the consolidation of certain welfare programs and also what I like to call wealthfare programs that target high-income individuals and corporations and those tax cuts and expenditures, you can consolidate all of those programs to help build that floor. And not to mention the recognizing the natural assets that no one person created. In society, we have the environment and all the natural abundance and wealth that our environment provides. We have our financial system, which no one person is responsible for. And we have just all these assets that we don't recognize as, you know, creating wealth for everybody. And because no one person created it, everyone should have a share of the wealth that's being created from these things. And so you can put all those things into paying for a basic income and definitely be able to cover the cost.
All right, let's go to another caller, Roberta and San Leandro. Hello.
Hi there. Thank you for the program. I'm going to ask this because I think it speaks to the heart of what your guests are saying. But if in America we looked at regionally or even state by state, because California, as an example, to live in the Bay Area, you have to make at least 120 grand to be able to live comfortably, and I'm not saying wealthy. In Florida, you might be really wealthy, but here in California, you're not. So my point would be, regionally, if we look at our tax system in a slightly different way, where we people who are in the poverty level in the Bay Area, if that poverty level is, you know, based on basic services, like let's say it's $100,000, you have to do it on a regional basis. Otherwise, there's like too much of a socialist panacea kind of in the thought process. I'm not putting it down. I'm saying, so if we work with the current system, and we go beyond that and balance the income based on where people actually live and can get better education, to your guest's point, housing, et cetera, it will support everybody across the U.S. and also allow for regional and statewide growth from businesses that are local, because the people will be able to be educated the way they need to go into the next, you know, version of whatever work has to come, whether it's technical, AI, or anything else, And I think that we need to look at it at a, in a slightly different way. But I definitely appreciate what's going on here on your program today.
All right.
Awesome.
Thank you. Actually, Professor Carl Weiderquist, she makes a point. Why would you give the same amount to someone living in Mississippi as you would to someone living in California?
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be the same. But even if it was the same, having $12,000 a year in California is an awful lot better than having $0 a year in California. And that is what a lot of our homeless people are eligible for right now. We're way behind, and we've got to start somewhere. Now, when you talk about indexing it for regional costs, there's some difficult issues because you give people an incentive about where to live when you do that. If you have it the same everywhere, you're giving people an incentive to move to the area where rent and food costs the least. And if you equalize it completely, you're giving people an incentive to move to the areas that are already the most crowded. And both of those seem a little, an extreme of those seems a little bit too much, either extreme, where you're trying to say, okay, every poor person in San Francisco should move to Mississippi because that's where things are cheap. That would be kind of tough, but also it would be tough if you're saying, well, we're going to make sure that you can live just as well living in San Francisco as you can living in Mississippi on the basic income. So maybe everybody should move there, and even more people will move to San Francisco. So there might be a happy medium where you could index it somewhat, but not fully. Or there could be a system where there's a national basic income at a uniform level, and then states add on to that, the states that have higher income. There's no perfect solution to that question. I think that is an important issue, but I think it's good to remember that even if it is the same everywhere, it still makes a big help that people are not getting today.
Larry Cohen, you're chomping at the bit. Because I have a hunch that's a very common question,
yes,
right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think just to quickly add on to what Carl said, when you are talking about making sure that people have their basic needs met, it also means that giving them the freedom to make the choices that make sense to them. So if you're able to have a basic income as your starting point, you know, you may say, okay, I can maybe room with two or three other people and use that to help build my nest egg and live in a city like San Francisco. Or if it's better for my situation, I can go to a cheaper city outside of the major metropolitan area. But the great thing about basic income is it goes with you. And because it's the same for everyone as a starting point, it travels with you. So it frees you. It's more freedom to make the kinds of independent decision that every person should be able to make for themselves. So if you want to go live in a small city or a small town and start up your own startup or to grow a city from there because it's cheaper and it makes more sense for you, you can do that. And if you want to try and, you know, live with two or three roommates and make it work in a major city, you can. But what the important thing is, it's giving people the freedom to choose for themselves for their own situation. And I think this would actually lead to more growth in rural areas and communities that may have been thought to have been left behind, because you'll be able to bring your economic growth and your economic opportunities with you because you're traveling with the basic income. And so I think that would actually help bring more industry and more of the economy back into cheaper cities than what we have today.
We're talking today to Larry Cohen, founder of Build the Floor. He's an advocate for universal basic income across the country. And to Associate Professor Carl Weiderquist. He's a political professor of philosophy at Qatar Georgetown University and co-founder of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network. And we're talking about universal basic income. Does it make sense? And we have lots of callers who are really interested in the concept. Let's go to Karen in San Francisco. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. I've been listening to the program, and unless I missed it, the universality of this program did not specifically include retirees. These are people who are not going back into the workforce, but many of whom are struggling to survive on their Social Security alone. So I'm not clear, would they retain their Social Security and this would be a supplement?
Let's see. What would the formula be? Would that be plus Social Security, or like so many people are concerned, would this supplant not just Social Security, but things like food stamps, SNAP programs, the earned income tax credit, housing vouchers? I know for libertarians who are really in support of this, they like the idea of being able to eliminate all those other programs and being able to supplant it with a UBI, with universal basic income. Larry Cohen?
Sure. I think we can address that question in a sensible way when UBI is implemented. We can take the programs that make less sense to be distributed and targeted, like food stamps and Section 8, because cash can help cover both of those things, and consolidate those programs to help pay for it. In terms of Social Security, I think that with a UBI, UBI would become that starting point, and then Social Security would be adjusted so that no senior citizen would ever have an amount lower than what they started with. So if you were making if you're receiving $1,200 a month currently, you would get $1,000 of basic income, and then, you know, a certain amount, at least $200 in Social Security. And so it sort of ensures that you're getting the basic income and Social Security on top of it. You're never starting below that, but you're always having a starting point of at least $1,000, no matter who you are and what age you are.
Carl, can you respond to that as well?
Sure. The Social Security is one of the best redistributive programs we have in the United States. I hope the Republicans are not able to attack it in this administration. It is one of the best because it's one of the ones that works most like basic income. In Britain, they have a means-tested Social Security system where as you save for retirement, they take that out of your government pension, and it's hard to tell whether I should save for retirement or not because the means testing is just going to lower what I get. Whereas Social Security, we get that whether or not we've saved for our retirement. We get that Social Security. That's like basic income. That's a good element. We don't want to lose that. Now, the cost I've done is assuming that Social Security remains as it is, which would mean you'd be adding this $12,000 a year to what you're already getting in Social Security, which I think would seem extremely generous to a lot of people. That would double what a lot of people are already getting on Social Security. I'd love to see that, but for an initial starting point, that might be more generous than what's actually like to happen. But whatever we do, it cannot involve making anybody who's on SSI or Social Security worse off than they are now. You can make it so they're only marginally better off, but you cannot make it so that they're worse off. People have worked for their entire lives paying into Social Security, and we've made a promise that if you pay in, you're going to get this. We absolutely cannot renege on that. That would be a horrible breach of trust to do that. So this has to be done in a way that is going to make Social Security recipients, hopefully make them all better off, at least somewhat, though it doesn't necessarily need to double what they're getting.
It occurs to me, too, gentlemen, that this issue has certainly made for some strange bedfellows. People from like Peter Thiel, you know, Trump supporting Peter Thiel, to union leader Larry Stern, Paul Ryan has weighed in on this, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, you've got people from all parts of the spectrum. Could this actually be a unifying issue for conservatives and liberals, Larry Cohen?
I believe so. I believe that universal basic income addresses the idea of basic economic security, and that crosses all political boundaries. That's getting back to sort of the starting point of how we view each other as human beings, how we treat each other with basic security, basic dignity, and basic opportunity as a starting point. And it doesn't matter what you believe politically, every person should have that freedom as a starting point in a society as wealthy as ours. Now, there are different ways that we're going to discuss and argue about the implementation and how much and how we do it. But at the end of the day, that's what the concept is about. And I think that's what's bringing these far-reaching groups of people together, because ultimately that's what we're all trying to succeed. And I hope that that's the genesis of where we can go forward with this debate going forward.
I meant to say union leader Andy Stern,
Andy
of course.
Stern, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? It occurs to me, too, that instead of, like some critics are saying, what appears to be redistributing how cash is spent, why not retrain people and prepare them for the 21st century in ways that continue to make them worker bees. I know that that may sound pejorative, but the fact is labor is part of the fabric of America. So why not spend money in retraining and preparing people for a 21st century economy as opposed to this sort of approach, Carl Widerquist?
Well, that's got a lot of problems. And then you've got to anticipate exactly what skills people are going to need in this fast-changing economy, and you're going to make mistakes. But then what you do is you're not dealing with that incentive problem that I talked about earlier. You're pumping out a bunch of people with new skills who then have to get a job. And when they have to get a job, then people who pay for those jobs don't have an incentive to offer them good wages. You've got to have that incentive to have people good wages. That's why our wages have stagnated for 40 years. The typical worker in the United States is not any better off now than the typical worker was in the 1970s. Yet the 1% is way better off than they were. All of the growth that we've had in all those years has not been shared out the way it had been shared out for the previous 50 years. It was growth was always going to the rich and the poor alike, sometimes more to the poor, a bigger share to the poor than to the rich. It's been the opposite for 40 years because of this incentive we created where you don't get anything unless you do what you're told. We need to end that to create this incentive.
Carl Widerquist, thank you for that, because that's one of those questions that was hanging out there. I'm glad you got to address that as we have about 2 minutes left. Larry Cohen, closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think on that subject of how we retrain the workforce of the 21st century, I believe in everybody in the American people figuring out what it is that they need to do to be able to get a job or in the future economy, or being able to find out what skills they need and going after that once they have their basic needs met. You can go after those skills and find what skills that you would be best suited for if you have your basic needs met, if you can cover your food, your shelter, things like that. That's when you can go figure out what it is that you want to be doing and go learn those skills. We need to be enabling people the freedom to choose those skills for themselves, and retraining would be helpful, but that isn't the solution. We need to enable people to be able to have the chance to retrain themselves.
All right. Larry Cohen, founder of BuildTheFloor.org, thank you for being here. And Carl Widerquist, a professor of SFS Qatar Georgetown University. A really fascinating discussion on universal basic income. Thanks for all of your calls. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you. Hope you'll join us for the next version. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is Your Call.